WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In the lead up to this year's socially distanced holiday season, we're looking at ideas of and about family, even the difficult ones. We know we have family members who have different political opinions, and we know some of you have told us about family members who have gone to some dark places, believing in conspiracy theories and blindly following people. So we wanted to share the story of someone who broke free from the hold of her family beliefs. I spoke with Megan Phelps Roper, who was raised in the Westboro Baptist Church. Her grandfather founded the church in 1955, and it's well known for antagonizing anyone who diverges from its narrowly defined idea of Christianity. The church, which is primarily Megan's extended family, is perhaps most known for its use of hateful speech that they believe represents the word of the Lord. And a disclaimer for our listeners with this segment: while it's about family, it's not necessarily appropriate for everyone in your family. We are going to be quoting some of the hateful speech that the church has propagated over the years. Megan herself began disseminating the church's violent message on Twitter. But in 2012, she had an encounter and a profound realization that her family's church wasn't spreading gospel, but hate. The realization prompted her to leave the church as well as her family, but it was a difficult process. Megan has published a book about her experience of both being raised in the church and the challenges of leaving it. It's titled Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. And when she came on the show last year, we talked about the difficulty of loving her family, even while vehemently disagreeing with them. I began the interview by asking about the moment Megan knew she was going to leave the church.
I started having conversations with people on Twitter, and a lot of them were full of the same kind of hostility that I experienced on the picket line, but then there was this group of individuals who started asking me questions and getting into the nuance of Westboro's ideology, and in doing so, they were able to find contradictions that I had missed my entire life. And in that process, like that was the first thing that allowed me to first to question and then to doubt and then ultimately to reject Westboro's teachings and sort of unraveled this everything that I had built my life on.
And for people who are curious, how could you have ignored the contradictions your whole life?
I wouldn't say that I ignored them. I would say that I just didn't see them. I think that the things that were pointed out to me on Twitter were things that Westboro didn't have an answer for previously. So this, at that point, I was in my early 20s. Before that, Westboro always had an answer from the Bible that would satisfy me. So as long as you could show me something from the Bible that would explain or justify why we needed to be doing this thing, these things, why we needed to go out and be, you know, protesting gay people, picketing at funerals, as long as there was a biblical explanation for it, you know, I would go along with it because I believed what I'd been taught, which is that the Bible is the literal and infallible word of God and that Westboro had the only legitimate interpretation of it. And since they always had an answer, my family, they're full of lawyers, they're very intelligent, analytical, they have these, you know, the ability to argue and debate, and there was always things to back up our position. And so it wasn't until I got on Twitter that these people who, you know, I think before Twitter, it could be difficult for people to get into it was hard to get into nuance at protests, which is, you know, full of shouty talking points and, you know, people, everybody's, you know, talking at the top of their voice, you know, singing, chanting. It's not really wasn't in my experience really the place for good, profound, deep theological debate. But Twitter became that for me.
It's interesting that, and I wanted to make that point in the intro, you and your family and people who are still in church, you thought you were doing the right thing. You never questioned whether what you were doing was right, correct?
Well, I mean, if I did have a question, again, as long as there was a Bible passage to explain why it was important, why we needed to do these things and believe these things, then I would go along with it.
You have this really interesting passage. You talk about the moment that you knew. What led up to this moment? And then I'm going to ask you to read this passage.
What led up to this moment was, you know, about a year and a half, a little over a year actually at this point, earlier, a group of eight men had taken over as elders, you know, in the church. And they started to do things that I absolutely believed were unscriptural. They were unbiblical. And it was very clear to me the way that they were treating other people in the church and certain decisions that they made were unbiblical. Before Twitter, I would have just gone along with it. I would have assumed that the problem was with me, that this was just, I wasn't spiritual enough to understand why they were taking these actions. So that had always been my position, to distrust myself and to put my trust in the church as long as there was this biblical explanation. And, you know, being introduced to these doubts on Twitter, you know, that for me, that was the sort of this thread that began to unravel the rest of the ideology as these other things happened. So in the moment, you know, this passage that I'm about to read, I've been ruminating on this for now over a year and trying to make sense of these two strong beliefs that I have. The one strong belief is that Westboro is the truth of God, that we had the truth of God, that we preached it, that this was not our message, but God's. And the other strong belief was that we were doing things that were unbiblical. And trying to reconcile those two, I couldn't until this moment where I finally had this thought of, what if we're just people? What if this isn't? We're not doing this at the behest of God, but because my grandfather, this is a reflection of his beliefs and his personality. So I wrote, I crossed a chasm in that split second, pursuing a thought my mind had never truly imagined and now could never take back. With stark clarity, I understood that whether the church was wrong or right, I was a monster. If we were wrong, then I had spent every day of my life industriously sowing doom, discord, and rage to so many, not at the behest of God, but of my grandfather. I had wasted my life only to fill others with pain and misery. And if the church was right, then asking those questions and even beginning to consider their implications was an unforgivable betrayal of everyone I had ever loved and the ideals I dedicated my life to defending. In my mind, I was a betrayer already. I thought of my mother, and the guilt was crippling. I didn't deserve to be part of this body of believers. The Lord was done with me, and Esau, after all, already condemned, overwhelmed by a sudden pressing need to leave that instant, every part of my body hummed with a single vicious accusation. You don't belong.
My guest is Megan Phelps Roper. She was reading from her new book, Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. You didn't leave right away, correct?
Right. No, yeah.
So how did you prepare to leave?
So it was about a four-month period from that moment until the day that I actually left. And in that time, I felt like I was going, you know, I was boomeranging back and forth between these two extremes. The one being, you know, the church is right. You know, this is Satan whispering in my ear. This is a test from God. And then the other side feeling like, you know, no, I know this is wrong. This is so clearly a contradiction. This is wrong. This is unscriptural. And kind of having those Bible verses, you know, flowing through my mind. And so trying to find solid ground to stand on, you know, I basically had come to the conclusion that, okay, I understand these things are wrong, but maybe I can convince other church members and they'll change. You know, and eventually I came to realize after, you know, trying to talk to other people and realizing, you know, feeling like I was just repeatedly running into a brick wall, you know, this, for them, it was so clear, as clear and plain as it had always been to me. And so to try to get through that, those mental barriers that they had erected, it wasn't going anywhere. So I realized that at some point, unless something drastic changes, I'm going to have to leave. I prepared by... You know, I loved my family dearly. You know, when you leave Westboro, you are completely cut off from them. And since the church is almost entirely my extended family, it's my history. I had thought it was my future. And so, you know, kind of looking back and, you know, all of a sudden I realized there was so much about my family that about their history that I didn't know. So I started asking questions and taking photos and saving family recipes, all these things, you know, collecting memories, things that I would not have access to once I left. And it just felt like everyone was dying, you know, like I was preparing for the death of everyone that I knew and loved and trusted in the world.
Did you have any idea where you would go?
Initially, not really. One of the things that I came to doubt about Westboro is that how we spoke about ex-members of the church. So there was, you know, the narrative about ex-members, you know, they're the worst of the worst. And so, you know, I eventually started to think, like, I had my cousin Libby was a very good friend of mine. She had been when she was in the church, and she had by this point been gone for over 3 years. And you know, I started to realize, you know, we say all these things about her, but I don't actually know who she, I mean, she was so great when she was here. She's probably not a completely different person. And so I reached out to her and was there for a few weeks after I left.
Your sister came with you, right?
Yes. So, you know, the moment that passage that I just read, that occurred while I was painting in the basement of a friend. And, you know, I turned in that moment to put the paintbrush down. I thought I had to leave that moment. And when I turned, I saw my sister who was painting the wall behind me. And I realized that she had been the only person in the church who, when I would present these questions and doubts and things that did not add up and things that were unscriptural, she was the only person who would not say, like, just go talk to the elders. They'll set you straight. Like, you know, she was the only one who would actually acknowledge, like, actually, this does seem wrong. Actually, this doesn't make sense. And to just let that be its own, you know, its own answer. And so I realized, like, you know, maybe she has thought of leaving. Maybe, you know, I just couldn't leave without talking to her. And it was a really terrifying conversation because, you know, according to the church, her duty in that moment was to turn me in immediately and without hesitation or question of any kind. And so to be having this conversation with my sister over those 4 months, it was really difficult and terrifying, but it was also wonderful to have, you know, this beloved sister, to think that I wasn't going to lose absolutely everything and everyone. Like, at least I would get to keep her.
My guest is Megan Phelps Roper. The name of her memoir is Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. Why did your grandfather start this church, Megan?
So he actually didn't start it. I mean, he was the first pastor. He was a traveling preacher. He came to Topeka in 1954. And, you know, this church, he was going to preach for a short period at this church called the Eastside Baptist Church in Topeka. And they liked him so much, they asked him if he would stay and, you know, become the preacher at this new church they were starting on the other side of town, Westboro. And that's where it started. You know, he was just a very strong believer. He got saved as a teenager at a tent revival meeting in the South, and he just thought it was his duty to, you know, call the world to the wedding feast, the marriage supper of the Lamb. You know, to follow Jesus. That was his duty in life.
There's an interesting thing about your grandfather's past, is that he actually worked as a civil rights lawyer. He was very interested in civil rights, as your mom, at least this is the family story, as your mom told it, that he grew up in the Deep South, and he, as your mom said, he saw the way those black people were treated, my mother told me, right, and by the mercy of God, he knew that it was wrong. And that you write, I heard Gramps preach against racism with the same venom he employed against gays, and it was clear that he saw his civil rights work in the same way he saw our daily picketing, as a moral imperative. I noted a similar accusation people made about our protesting, too, and that it was all about making money. But your grandfather had this interesting part of his legacy and his life. What did you think about that, especially after you left?
I mean, I think it really shows that my family are not all evil. Like, it's very easy to look at the protests because they are so provocative, and they have, for a very long time, used the harshest most confrontational language in the most sensitive settings, you know, protesting at funerals and things like that. And with these, you know, these signs that anybody looking at them, you know, you immediately feel how wrong this is. And so it's easy to look at them as like only a monster, only a person deliberately wanting to do evil could possibly say these things. And I think, you know, the fact that my grandfather also has this other part of his legacy where he had these decades of civil rights work, you know, award from the NAACP and these other black civil rights groups, that they really were motivated by good. And it's just their understanding of the Bible, their interpretation of it, that worldview is just so destructive. I write in the book and say all the time, I don't believe that they're evil people. I think that they are good people who have been persuaded by bad ideas. I think, you know, my mom's generation was indoctrinated the same way that I was into this ideology, even though the picketing didn't start until later, until I was five.
You know, when I've seen you speak, and when you say that, some people get really offended when you
right.
describe that your family isn't evil and these people aren't being evil. Do you understand why people get offended when you say that?
Absolutely. I think part of the distinction here is how we're using the word evil. Like, I take evil to be, for somebody to be evil, it is to be deliberately hurting someone because you want to hurt them. And for my family, they saw and see their preaching as a manifestation of their love of their neighbor, right? Because they're going to go and warn people. And so it's a good motive and a very, very bad outcome. So I do understand, and I also do acknowledge that I think that they do evil sometimes. I think that what they do, particularly at funerals, for me, that is something that still causes me a lot of grief when I think about it. To think about what we did to those families, which was not, you know, we always had all these justifications for it, but there's this passage in the New Testament where the Apostle Paul says, you know, to the weak I became as weak, that I might gain the weak. And that's not what we did. It's absolutely not what we did. We did the opposite. We went to people in their weakest, most vulnerable, heartbreaking, heart-wrenching moments and were said and did extremely cruel things. And I have to live with that still. So I do understand why people get upset. But I also think that the vast majority of people that I've spoken with, even people who have been terribly hurt by the church, you know, can look at that and understand they unlike my family, who, you know, for them to have empathy for people outside of the church is not an easy thing. I understand it works in the opposite direction too, but a lot of people outside have been able to have empathy, to understand that the people in the church, the vast majority of them, grew up in it and were indoctrinated, and that I think has actually helped them kind of move on from the hurt, understanding that wasn't the goal. It's very complicated and sad and difficult, and I so wish that it wasn't so, that we hadn't done all those things. But I don't know what to do except now to be honest about that experience and to talk about it and to find ways of making amends.
My guest is Megan Phelps Roper. The name of her new memoir is Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. We'll have more with Megan after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Megan Phelps Roper. Her new book is called Unfollow, a Memoir of Loving and Leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. And again, just for our listeners who might have kids in the room, we're discussing adult themes, and there's some language used by the church and by its members that is both derogatory and very hurtful. So if you want to catch us on the podcast, that might be the best choice if you've got children in the room at the moment. Megan, can you describe your childhood for us? What was it like to grow up and be a little kid and a member of the Westboro Baptist Church?
Well, the picket lines were a huge part of it. It was something that the church did every single day. So most days I was out, you know, standing on the sidewalk, on public sidewalks all around the city of Topeka, and then eventually sidewalks across the country. preaching to people Westboro's message. And of course, standing on the picket line, that draws a lot of hostility. People would scream and yell, moon us, throw things, and drive their cars at us. It was not, you know, and come after us on foot. I mean, it was an extremely us-them kind of environment. And the fact that outsiders were so hostile, like that it kind of reinforces the bond that you have with other people within the church. And so within the church, as long as you were a member in good standing, the sense of camaraderie and love and, you know, this feeling that you'll do anything for one another, you know, the church is, I mean, again, as long as you're a member in good standing, extremely loving and willing to sacrifice for each other. And it's this, in a lot of ways, it's a really, really beautiful thing. It's a wonderful feeling to be surrounded by people who show you love and care and attention, like all the time. We did everything together. And that part was incredible too. I mean, so we did normal things. I loved to read as a kid, all kinds of, you know, sci-fi and, you know, supernatural things especially. But Stephen King was a big draw, but, we played video games, we did homework, we went to public school. So in some ways our lives were extremely normal and loving and wonderful. And then there was this other side but the thing about it is that the theology of the church, and the doctrines like permeated everything that we did. There was always, you know, we read the Bible and had, you know, Bible study every single night, and, you know, I would often be memorizing passages and, you know, engaging in this kind of theological debate on the picket line all the time, and or at least, you know, in the limited way that you can on the picket line. But you were just, and then documentary filmmakers coming and filming and trying to understand who we were and why we were doing this. All of that was just how life was.
It's very interesting on the website. You know, most websites say you can't distribute this information, it's copyrighted. At the bottom of the website for Westboro Baptist Church, it says, you can spread this however you like. Please use at will. Tell me a little bit more about how the church was able to use the media, because it's not that big a church, yet it had such a big impact. And were you all aware of using the media? Was that part of the plan?
Yes, absolutely. The church calls itself, you know, a great publishing company. So that the important thing to know is that they're actually not trying to change people's hearts and mind. They are just trying to preach this message, the unvarnished word of God as they understand it, and how it lands on the hearts of the hearers or readers is in the hands of God alone. It's because they believe in predestination. So they don't believe that they can change anybody. All they can do is preach. So that was our entire goal was just to publish this message to as many people as we could in as many different avenues as we could, because that was, again, that was how we showed love for our neighbor. We were giving people an opportunity to repent. We're telling them, you're doing wrong. If you want the blessings of God instead of his curses, then this is how you have to live. Just be like us, basically. And so, you know, the thing about, you know, their message is that, you know, my grandfather realized almost immediately, you know, that we live in a soundbite generation. So we'd have these 3 to 5 words on a neon picket sign standing in, you know, these, you know, any location where there were people. So this is why, like, if you look at the website now, you'll see some of their protests and it'll be like, you know, sporting events, you know, and things like that. It's like, it's not that playing sports is evil. It's just that we need to preach to those people. And that's, you know, what also eventually brought me to Twitter. Like, how can we use these communication, you know, these tools of communication to kind of co-opt them, to use it in support of our message? And we didn't care. You know, you mentioned on the website, use our words, our parodies, use them however you want. We didn't care that the vast majority of people who wrote about us were saying a lot of terrible things about us. We didn't care that they were being, you know, personally disparaging of us at all. As long as they, you know, quoted a picket sign or one of our members standing on the picket line, that was good enough for us. You put our words in there and we don't care what else you say.
You include in the book some of the different chants and some of the different sayings and slogans, and one that's really sort of, it's difficult, and I'm going to read this, listeners, I want you to know. It was shortly after the deaths of Mother Teresa. Princess Diana, and it's a sing-along parody that was written by your mom and your aunt, and it goes along to Elton John's Candle in the Wind. So everybody get ready. Goodbye, royal whore, though you never spoke the truth, you know and hear it now, as do all this world's youth. You crashed into the stone wall as you played your whorish games. They set you on a pedestal and bowed down to your name. But it seems to me you lived your life like a harlot full of sin. God cut you off, now the flame set in. And you know we told you, though you're a thrown away, your name will die out long before the pain will ever sway. Why was that useful in the church's mind?
We would seize upon any, you know, any usage of pop culture to co-opt it, to use it for our message. So we would say, well, the original lyrics to that song were idolatrous and have, you know, putting Princess Diana on a pedestal, and, you know, she was not a good example. She was an adulteress. You know, she clearly is in hell. We had a sign that said that she was in hell. And, you know, royal whore in hell, I think is actually what it said. And that, you know, so we were taking these things that had been used in our minds as in this very sinful way, and trying to, you know, put this righteous message, like, this is the truth of the situation. And so we need to, you know, use the same vehicle that you have used it for sin to say something positive, to say something godly and righteous.
You mentioned how the church uses the media. It also uses the law. Your grandfather insisted that all 13 of his children, all their spouses, get a law degree. And your mom managed the Phelps law firm, even though your grandfather was ultimately disbarred. How did they use the law to further the message?
Well, the thing is, like, they're not trying to break the law. They're not trying to, you know, physically hurt people. They're not trying to commit crimes. You know, the fact that they had law degrees, they would say that that was a good defense for them. Because when people would come after us, when the police or, you know, the local DA or, you know, any time people would come after us legally, we had this experience, this law, you know, they had done all those civil rights cases. They knew what it was like to be attacked in the courts, and they had a lot of experience that allowed them to defend us in the courts. I think, you know, there is this kind of myth about the church that really it's a money-making operation, and they go to these locations, these very sensitive locations, to just make people enraged so that they will be attacked, and then they can sue the attackers, and then also for the police for failing to protect them. And that has never happened. That is not Westboro's MO. They are not trying to have people attack them so they can make money. The law is, you know, for them, it is something that they've used in a defensive way, largely. You know, so they have been sued. The only occasions that they have actually gone to court is, you know, if a state or a municipality or some governing body has made a law that puts undue, you know, unconstitutional prohibitions, unconstitutionally limits their First Amendment rights, then they will go to court, again, not to make money, but because they want to preach. That is their primary goal in life. And so that's how they've used it.
My guest is Megan Phelps Roper. Her memoir is called Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. Why did your parents let you go to public school? I would think that seems like it's sort of the antithesis of
so
what you were about.
Right. Well, the church is entirely self-funded. So part of my job when I was there was on the very rare occasions that people would send money would be to send that money back and say, you know, quote this Bible verse that it basically says you and your money can both go to hell. You know, we are the ones responsible for this ministry. So they had to work. And so their homeschooling wasn't really an option there. But there was also, you know, this idea that they saw us as walking picket signs. That's what they called us. You know, our presence in the community, anytime somebody sees that name in the Topeka, you know, area in northeast Kansas, Phelps means, they would say, God hates fags. And so our presence in the community was a testimony against them, because whereas, you know, that's what the Bible verse says, whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they are beholding your conversation, like how you actually behave in school, at work, and they can see by the good way that you behave that you are not what they are accusing you of. So it was very important for us to be good students, to be polite and friendly and with outsiders. And we were. They weren't afraid for us to go to public school because, you know, they had prepared us too well for that. You know, the analogy that I use is that it's because of our religious education at home. Before we go to school or universe, wherever we are, and people are challenging us on these ideas, you know, it's like we have been inoculated against any doubts or questions that could come up, because before we were ever introduced to those doubts by outsiders, our parents, our family told us about, these are the kinds of arguments people are going to make. Here's why they're wrong. Here are the Bible verses that show they're wrong. Memorize them. So it's there's just this, you have this instinctive response to outsiders and the arguments that they make, and you always have an answer for why they're wrong. So it's kind of, it's these mental barriers that keep other people out.
Yet Twitter proved to be the one way the outside world got to you, and specifically someone who was Jewish.
Right, yes.
Why did this encounter have such an impact on you?
Well, all my years growing up, anytime there was a question that if I didn't immediately have the answer myself, if I hadn't already memorized it, I could take it to one of the older people in the church and get an answer. And there was always an answer from the Bible. There was always an answer to satisfy me, some justification for this thing, some explanation. You know, well, this person's wrong because they framed the question in the wrong way. This really is the appropriate biblical way of looking at this, and here's the verse that shows that. So there was always an answer. Twitter, there are several things about Twitter that made it so much more powerful for me. First of all, the fact that the conversations are happening over time means that I'm developing rapport with people. I'm starting to see them not just as this, you know, this person yelling at me on the picket line. It's somebody who's asking me questions, who's, you know, I'm watching their children grow older in the photos they're posting. I'm seeing them interact with their friends. I'm just seeing a side of people that I didn't see IRL, right? And whenever I was in real life, in physical space with other people. And when I was in physical space with other people, I always knew it was this instinct to keep them at arm's length. I never trusted them. And online, you know, this physical distance from those people allowed me to be open and vulnerable in a way that I just never had been before. And because it was so limited, because it was only 140 characters, right? I felt safe. You know, I didn't think there was any way that they could. I had no expectation that they would be able to influence me in any way unduly. And so getting into the nuance of that, of those arguments, and for them to find a contradiction that I could then, you know, I go looking for an answer and instead I get shut down and I realize there is no answer. They're not addressing the contradiction here. They're reiterating the verses that justify them. But what about this one that contradicts? And so that was, you know, the realization that we could be wrong was the first seed of doubt. And it was so powerful because I hadn't really thought about the fact that, you know, I basically had seen Westboro as having a monopoly on truth. Their message was divine. It was godly. And therefore, there was no way that we could be wrong about anything. And so to be faced with that was, even though it was a relatively small point of theology, it was that realization that was so mind-blowing to me.
Who was the person who accomplished this?
It was David Abbotball, who runs a blog called Jewlicious. And he was, in his argument, he actually ended up quoting Jesus, you know, saying, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." He was doing that in response to a protest sign that we had calling for the death penalty for gays. And, you know, we justified that, you know, from the book of Leviticus. And would say, you know, if that punishment is good enough for God, then it's good enough for us, and it's the only way for this nation to show that they have truly repented of the sin of homosexuality. So he made that point, you know, about, you know, casting the first stone. And my response was what Westboro always said, which was, "We're not casting stones, we're preaching words." And he said, "Yeah, but you're advocating that the government cast stones." And then he said, you know, "And also, didn't your mother have a child out of wedlock?" And, you know, our response to that had always been, "Yes, and that doesn't make it right. She has repented of that sin, and therefore," he said, "yeah, but that's another sin that deserves the death penalty. If she had been killed, you know, your family would not exist." And that, like, I kind of was shocked. I didn't know what to say to either of those two points, you know, because Jesus did say, you know, that point about casting stones, only the sinless should cast stones. And we all readily acknowledge that we were sinners. That wasn't, you know, it was never part of our, but anyway, so, I mean, it was a mind blowing moment for me. And I didn't know what to do with it except to stop holding that sign. And then, you know, and again, that was the beginning of the unraveling process.
Do you still speak with anyone inside the church?
I reach out to them. I send, you know, I make these arguments. I do make them in interviews. I make them on Twitter. I make them in private, you know, letters and postcards and things that I send. I do reach out to them. I almost never get a response. Usually, I mean, if I do, it's on Twitter. It's, you know, there's a... Anytime, you know, because they're trying to get attention for the church, you know, their MO is generally to, when they cut you off and they really try not to acknowledge you publicly in any way. And basically the only exception to that is when, you know, if you do something that gets a lot of attention. So I gave a TED talk a couple of years ago that drew their ire. And basically they're just trying to, again, to co-opt that and bring it back to be about their message.
That was my conversation with Megan Phelps Roper about her book, Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.